Yeah, I might as well. Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Milsurp World, your podcast all about military surplus. I'm Aaron, and today we're joined by Danny and Mark. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hello, everybody.
Today's topic, we're going to talk about military surplus books, do's and don'ts, stuff to look for, stuff to avoid, for sure. There's a lot of stuff to avoid that people get trapped on. But normally we talk about what's been going on. It's been a little bit since our last podcast. Anything happened, Danny?
Yeah, there's been a few things that happened. Me personally, I had a kid, so he is 6 days old, so it's crazy. So if I say anything dumber than usual, I claim it's because just lack of sleep. But good stuff, man.
He's numbers matching, right?
Yeah, he is. He's cosmoline free. When we got him, we had to strip him down, remove all the cosmoline.
Oh yeah.
I came in.
Looked like a gremlin.
Yep.
Oh
yeah.
Everybody's
that's funny because that's not far off from the truth. When they get there.
I'm telling you guys, for those of you that have not experienced it, the shit they show in the movies is not how they come out looking. They do not come out looking like humans.
Yeah, it's pretty much the whole labor delivery and everything is just completely different than movies or anything. It was intense, man. My wife was in labor for 36 hours.
Champion.
So we spent 4 days 4 days in the hospital. I slept on this stupid little couch for 4 days, four nights.
Is it the chair that folds into the couch, or is it?
I wish it was one of those. It was like the couch, the back cushion, folded down.
Oh no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was rough. And they don't provide, that hospital doesn't provide food to the husband. Yeah. So they only which
tough
I guess
shit.
Makes sense. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know of some places that they give food to the spouse or partner, whoever's in the room.
Now that I think about it, I don't think the one we were at provided food either, but the food in the cafeteria is super cheap there, so.
Yeah. It was a little rough. I think I lost 3 or 4 pounds in those 4 days just from, not eating and sleeping and what, I don't know what, stress or something. But,
yeah.
It was an experience.
Mark, anything been happening to you? Did we lose Mark again?
Oh. Mac.
Oh, okay. Well, not much has been going on for me. Automotive manufacturing is really tough right now. If anybody's noticed your local dealership's not having any cars, it's because the supply chain is fucked. And that's about it. And Mark's going to be coming back, it seems. He's got some issues, technically. Mark's back!
Maybe. Well, you want to just get into the topic?
Yeah, I guess we can go ahead and start the topic. Unless there's anything else comes to mind.
Well,
Mark, we cannot hear you if you're trying to talk. Just a heads up.
Yeah.
You blew into your microphone.
Hey, Mark.
Mark is in a windstorm, guys.
So I think before when we talk about books, we should just sort of talk about the common sense, aspect of this, or
why buy books.
Yeah, why buy books? Because knowledge is power.
Information is ammunition.
Yes, yes.
I'll see how many of you get that reference.
Knowing the right thing at the right time can either save you a lot of money or it can earn you a lot of money. Because you can recognize something that maybe not a lot of people recognize. And maybe a lot of people aren't buying it because they don't recognize a certain feature or whatever. We're kind of the opposite of that. Like, you recognize a feature and why it's not worth as much as everybody thinks it is, so then you don't buy it. So
yeah.
There's the obvious financial impact of of knowing it, but simply owning the book doesn't actually do a whole lot if you don't crack it open and read it, which is sort of the hard part for me. I have to sort of make myself read, and really kind of doing a video is the best motivation that I get for actually cracking open a book and kind of reading it. Because a lot of times, a lot of these books, like, I wouldn't even buy or read if it wasn't for the fact that I had to make a video and I had to do it. But once I do it, once I read, you know, read, go through them, I'm happy I did. But, and it's one of those interesting things too. Like, you know, there's a lot of gun books, and so you don't like just want to buy like all gun books without first owning a gun, maybe, right? Like if you didn't own any Mausers, you just weren't into Mausers, you probably wouldn't want to own a Mauser book. Or if you haven't bought one yet. So it's like an interesting thing where it seems like a lot of people, you know, like if you ran across like a Walther PPK for sale, but you don't know jack shit about Walther PPKs, it's hard to then like be like, okay, well, this one's for sale, I'm interested in it, let me go online, find a good Walther PPP, you know, Walther PP or PPK book and buy it and get it in time and read it. And then the tricky part is of finding out, like, was that even a good book? Is that a trusted reference? Mm-hmm. Like, what do collectors, you know, read when it comes to any particular gun? Because there are good books and bad books with any given, you know, any given topic. Kind of like what you were talking about with your M95s.
It's a good example, yeah. I wouldn't say they're bad books, but there's a lack of them.
What about in German?
Yeah, there's more in German, yes. So if you can read German, then you have a lot more reference points. And unfortunately, I don't, so...
Google Translate.
Yeah, yeah. The issue, and especially that you run into, and Othias mentions this, I've talked to him about this before as far as translating stuff, especially when you get old German, like High German,
mm-hmm.
Translating technical details is super difficult.
That's true.
But... yeah, like, basic information shouldn't be that big of an issue to translate, yeah. But there's just a lot of information out there, and everybody's trying to make money, obviously. So there's some stuff we would recommend to avoid first for the new people. But everybody falls for this at first, right, Danny? Those catalogs?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the one. I mean, I think maybe when I was first getting into guns or something like that, I bought a couple, and you find them in Barnes and Nobles, and it's like top 100 guns that changed the world or something like that. And it's like, oh, it's a neat book. So you pick it up.
It's a coffee table book, guys. It's the big thick stacks of books that you see where it's like a standard catalog of all military firearms or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are always, like, I guess, interesting. Maybe they're super, like, entry level for people who are just starting off with, you know, with firearms and wanting to learn that kind of stuff. But I think the rule is, you know, the more general a book is like that, the less information that they give, you know, because if a book covers, you know, a bunch of different guns, it's not going to give a whole lot of information about any particular one of those.
I would say that most of the time it's probably less... like informative about a specific model than a Wikipedia entry would be.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's true. That's like another thing with, you know, with a lot of these books and stuff in general is that, yeah, Wikipedia exists and you could just go on there and read them. And I mean, there's some YouTubers who like pretty much base their videos on like Wikipedia, you know, and they just read a Wikipedia article and then they make their, I'm not going to say any YouTubers' names, but they, you know, they make their videos. And they could be full of, it could be full of, you know, misinformation about whatever gun they're covering, but.
Or it's very generalized.
Yeah, yeah. Or super, super generalized. But it's, yeah, it's one of those things. Like, it's got to be, the books, the juice has got to be worth the squeeze, you know, when it comes to certain books. And, I don't know if it's, I'm just, something I've noticed a lot lately, it seems like a whole lot of gun books are out of print or going out of print. Like a lot of staples that people would need. I'm trying to think of the Mauser Military Rifles of the World.
I think that's available on Kindle or something, but that's about your Amp or Fire, whatever Amazon has.
Yeah, like that one. I mean, I think the whole suite of collector grade publications are now out of print. Right.
Well, not all of them, but Blake Stevens, who ran it, died a few years ago. So that I assume that has some. He was their head honcho.
Yeah, So are they out of print, or are they just kind of still available? And
they're still available, but if you go on their website, I think their catalog's a lot less than it once was.
Which, this is something I didn't actually plan on talking about. Like, when it comes to certain books, they're actually pretty good investments.
Oh, yes. Like, Clausen's 1911 book is about $1,000, just as an example.
Yeah. It's pretty nuts. You know, the books, they're not crazy expensive or anything. Maybe when they once come, you know, when they first come out, maybe $50 to $100 or whatever. But then, yeah, they go out of print. Maybe that's the book, you know, the best book, reference book on a particular firearm. And then, yeah, it goes out of print, and then it skyrockets, you know, 4 or 5 to, you know, to tenfold of its original cost, which is kind of like an interesting thing. You would never think about like a reference book, you know, being a good investment, especially when it comes to the gun. But I wonder if maybe the value of the gun that it's covering influences that as well.
I think so.
If it was a book covering like a cheap gun, maybe it's not worth it. But when you're dealing with 1911s, you know, guns that are, you know, multiple thousands of dollars a piece, then maybe spending, you know, $1,000 on a decent reference book makes sense for, you know.
That would.
Yeah. When Aaron and I talked earlier about actually doing this topic, I was like, we got to get Mark on here. Because I think I've seen a picture of your reference library a while back.
I've got a few books.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say, like in middle school, when the internet was coming into fruition, they'd always say, look at your sources. You don't want to cite Wikipedia, like you said. But like you say, you don't want to go pick up a coffee table book at Barnes & Noble's or Books A Million or wherever. But something from collector grade is probably going to be good. Something you look at the publisher, look at the author. You know, that plays a big role into it. But there are some, well, Ball's Military Mauser is great as like a cursory overview of each different country, but it's not going to tell you what Sauer fonts look like compared to Obendorf fonts on a K98. It's not going to break down like the little nuances and stuff on a specific model. And frankly, some of the information there is dated. Like they talk about the Argentine 91 Mausers that got diverted to Cuba. And I believe they say it shouldn't have a lock in the magazine, but we found out later that's BS. They do. Because nobody had ever seen one when that book was written. Some of the serial number data on Belgian Mausers is out of date, we know now. Stuff like that. Same thing goes for Backbone of the Wehrmacht. But it's just too broad. It's too broad to be specific, but it's a good book you should have in your library just to give you kind of a cursory overview to identify whatever the Mauser is.
Yeah. Ball, yeah, he does get some of his information. It's definitely incorrect, but some of it, it's, you know, some of the guns in there, there's like no other information on pretty much, except for, you know, like a few paragraphs in his book. So, I would say that's definitely a must have for, you know, for Mauser collectors. But take it with a grain of salt. Like it's not 100%.
Exactly. I mean, it was groundbreaking. It's still a good book. It's probably 95, 97% good. And it's just a couple minor things that we've learned with time. I mean, I think, well, I spoke to a good friend of mine the other day. We got talking. Some of his South American Mausers were going to be in the next edition of Ball's book. He was good friends with Robert Ball and John Wall, well, more so John Wall, who's another big Mauser collector who's passed, unfortunately. And unfortunately, Robert Ball died the next year before his guns could get in there. I mean, if those guys had lived, I think we'd still be seeing ongoing editions. But the problem is, like I said earlier, with collector grade publications, fortunately, a lot of these guys are dying off. So nobody's there to carry the torch for real academic research. Like how many people, I mean, Othias, I know, reads the primary sources, but how many people are out there doing the research? I know Morrow is, but it's a very small minority, you know? It's not like we're doing as much groundbreaking research as we did 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. It's interesting. Yeah, there's seems to be a tapering off. Like, I don't know what it is. A generational change?
I mean, Collector Grade's a good publishing outfit, and Mowbray's another good one, but they cover a lot more broad than just military stuff. Wet Dog Publications, they cover a lot of FN stuff. The Banzai, who cover obviously Japanese and some Siamese stuff, they're really good when it comes to Arasakas. Like The Type 38 book by Frank Allen. It's out of print, sadly, but I think he's working on a new edition. That details how Kokura would match their guns versus Nagoya. That's one little thing a lot of people don't realize. Like the early Japanese rifles all matched by assembly number. They didn't match by serial number, but then later some parts might match by assembly and others by serial number, or some match all by serial. That book breaks down how they match, what we know for production numbers, because a lot of that stuff's lost because of the war, how metal finish should look, what inspection stamps are. It's just a really super book. That's the kind of thing, if you're going to look at guns, I mean, you're going to look at guns from a collector's standpoint, that's the book you want. I mean, there are books that look more from a historical perspective. There are books that look more from a collector's perspective or the bigger picture. There's another book by Dieter Storrs on the GU-98. It's the only real good book on the GU-98. He draws all his sources from the Bavarian War Museum, and he covers like how Simpson and Schell produced guns. He covers Amberg, but he doesn't go into nitty-gritty like what's this Amberg inspection stamp versus this is Erfurt, Spandau, whatever. It's strictly from that perspective, you know, museum's a big picture instead of a collector perspective, whereas other books go at it from a collector perspective, and other books go at it from both. You also kind of have to have, it depends on what you want to get out of the book, I guess, is the best way to put it. Do you want a collector's perspective? Do you want a historical perspective? Do you want the big picture? It's all about what you want and with the end game.
Yeah, and it's real interesting. Yeah, the age of the book... can really
be really nice if somebody wrote a book on the Guevara 98 detailing all these different inspection stamps. Not a lot of people know that. Like the K98, everybody's in the Third Reich guns.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we've got awesome 3-volume set by Kyrum and Steves, which covers everything. That's a must-have if you want to get into 98Ks. I mean, it covers that comes from a historical perspective and the big picture and a collector's perspective. Covers everything you're going to need to know. Exceptional book series, but unfortunately the first and third volumes are out of print now.
Yeah, you did mention, yes, Storrs, but I think we are missing a really good comprehensive book, you know, on, you know, it's like a book series maybe, right, on K98 days.
Yeah,
the Guevara 98s.
Say that again, Danny.
It would be good, you know, if there was a book series, yeah, like, you know, Steve's K98K series, a 4-volume series on, you know, something similar to that of, like, you know, Guevara 98s and K98As.
Exactly, even in the Weimar era.
Yeah, but, yeah. Yeah, very little stuff out there on Weimar guns.
But the problem is there's so few. People look at K98s like they're this holy grail, but there's a lot of them out there that are in original condition, matching, whatever. We know most of the stuff that there is to be known on them. I mean, there's always going to be something we don't know, but for the most part, we know most of it.
Wait, you mean my 1943 K98K isn't rare?
Yeah, it's a nice gun, but no, I wouldn't call it rare. It's certainly worth a good chunk of change. Nice gun, but just Weimar stuff, there's so much, and Imperial, there's so much mystery, like there, because there are so few surviving examples close to original condition. We don't know what acceptance patterns are, things like that. But that would be nice if somebody wrote a book on that. But anyway, that's kind of off the beaten path a bit.
Well, it's interesting, like, because the more niche I think a book is or a book topic is, then the least amount of, you know, revenue it's probably going to generate. So then there's passion projects. You know, I'm sure there's plenty of people that have, you know, money and they don't really care if their books are, you know, crazy successful. Maybe they just want to do it for, you know, just for, you know, future generations or whatever, or just out of their own hobby, which is neat. But yeah, maybe if we knew somebody or a few people that had between them 1,000 Guevara 98s that they've ruined the market collecting.
Oh yes, they forwarded them, and you can't find one, even though there was 20 on GunBroker and different auction sites in the past month.
Yeah, yeah. So that's pretty funny. You want to talk about that for a hot second?
Well, there's this somehow. I mean, there's this idea in the market, particularly among younger people. I mean, we're all younger here, but they think that somehow people that specialize in one gun or area that own more than a couple or one are hoarding them. But the reality of it is most of the time they're studying them. I mean, if you've got 10 books are good to a certain degree, and in some cases there are no books like Guevara 98s, but you have to really handle the gun to get a good grasp on it, what's right and what's wrong. But you have a bunch of a gun, some people want to have a gun from every country in every war. That's fine. Other people want to specialize. But there are people that think, oh, boomers are hoarding all these guns, and when they die off, that the market's going to flood and everything's going to be $200 again. I don't believe that.
Yeah, no.
And I mean, there are plenty of people our age that are buying this crap, and that's great. That's wonderful. But there are people that claim if you own more than like a couple of a gun, you're hoarding and you're ruining the market and you're preventing them from finding them and all this crap. It's like, okay. I mean, yeah, we own a lot of them, but we like them. We're not out there, you know, my friends and I like Gewehr 98. It's wonderful. I mean, other people like Grands. If you want to own 50 Grands, go ahead. It's not really ruining the market. You can go out and find one, too. There are plenty of them out there. There's a lot of the stuff out there from all the world wars, all the imports. But saying that they're hoarding them, insulting someone because they have more than you, just shows jealousy, if you ask me.
Yeah, it sounds... It's kind of interesting. It sounds a little Marxist or something. Like you're not allowed to own more than like a couple, or else you're like quite. I've said it like you know to your posts online. Like I've said it like you know
ironically,
but like people like thumbs up it and like comment like they believe it, and it's like oh that's funny.
And they probably all otherwise think they're right wingers, and without getting too much into politics, but
yeah, pretty Marxist for right wingers, yeah.
It's like, you know what? Mind your own business. But I mean, the people that specialize, you can own one gun, but you're not going to get the whole picture. You know what I mean? You're not going to understand all the different... I was talking with a friend the other day. He says, listen, you want to collect Nazi Lugers to get the whole picture? You're going to have a couple hundred guns and maybe even more. Just to show the difference between Kragoff, Mauser, year to year, whatever. It's just, some people like one thing, some people like several things. Just let it be.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing too. Yeah, if you want to get the whole picture, you got to own quite a few of them to just sort of begin to you know cover the different variations, and which is something that's probably difficult for our spouses. Like Sam doesn't understand why, you know, I'm like, no, we'll see. This is a different marking here, a different number here. And she doesn't understand at all.
And then her eyes just glaze over.
Oh yeah, the eye glaze over. Oh, our poor wives, man.
A little change, but go ahead.
I was gonna ask you, Mark. Have you put any thought? So a lot of people listening probably have no idea who you are, but I will tell them that you are pretty astute dude. You're smart. I don't know. I think I'm saying the wrong word. Like I said,
astute is how you pronounce it.
Stout means he's a rather large individual.
Astute. You're an astute. You're an esteemed collector, Mark.
Thank you.
Like the stupid trivia it was great, that trivia Tom pulled out for us, but it was dumb that it didn't get recorded. But like your score on there, it just shows like you're a smart dude. I think, have you thought about doing like writing a book or anything, man?
We've talked about it, a few of our cohorts who also quote-unquote hoard Gewehr 98.
Dirty hoarders.
But it's going to be a lot easier if you have 100 of them in front of you to work out the different details.
Yeah, you have to. Like any sort of decent reference book, like you need tons of pictures of, hundreds of examples maybe, you know, just to get the complete picture for the book. So I think that's good. Like when you were talking about it, I felt like you were hinting at maybe you were working on it. So, That's really cool. I would back your Kickstarter, Mark.
I appreciate that. But I probably won't be the primary driver in there. I'm kind of the new guy with Gewehr. I know a little bit, but I'm not... Well, I've got a friend named Cyrus. I was at a gun show with him in Ohio, and we were looking at a early Spandau, and he's looking at the inspection stamps with a real keen eye. He's questioning whether that's a Spandau inspection stamp on the band. That's something that's a little beyond me at this point, but hopefully I can learn that. You know, the guys like that really know their stuff.
Yeah. Well, there's always...
But anyway.
There's always that big learning curve. But just the fact that you would say that you don't know a lot means you know a lot.
Yeah, I can hear you, Mark.
Hello?
Yes, he can't hear us. Oh.
So, kind of talking to that with Mark about maybe, you know, him doing a book or whatever, it kind of goes into the next point of like... Kind of like how I like having doing videos with Mauro and kind of getting the word out there about his books, because I think it's an aspect of, you know, of just maybe buying these books, not only is, you know, just information good, and maybe it's just fun to read. But I think supporting these authors, you know, especially, you know, the books where the authors are alive, you know, supporting them, buying their books, it really helps to sort of support, you know, like future research and maybe these authors going and doing, you know, new books. They, you know, the only way that they will do that is if people buy their, you know, buy their current books. So not only just for the reasons of it's good to know, buy that book so you can have it, but also you're supporting the authors and, you know, helping further, you know, research on, you know, on different guns.
Exactly.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Hey, here's a question. I just sort of thought of this for everybody. If you had to go, if you're going to a desert island and you could only bring one gun book, which gun book would you bring?
That's so random.
There's a desert island like thing about that, but like, what book do you bring? But this is like, what gun book?
Probably Ball's book.
I mean, really?
General book.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, it is good.
Like I said, it has its flaws, but nothing comes close in terms of breadth.
Yeah, that's the he did a good job, you know, like we said before, the more general a book is, you know, they can really bite off more than they can chew. And I think there's a good balance to that one of covering a ton of different guns without losing too much. You know, a book that I have that I don't hardly ever crack open is Olson's Mauser Bolt Rifle book.
That's decent, but it's not as good as Ball's for military purposes.
Yeah, it's interesting because, yeah, so Ball's book is broken down like alphabetically by countries. So you can, you know, go to C's and look up Chinese or whatever. But Olson's book is chronological. It kind of goes through the development. But it's a little lacking in some details, some parts of it.
Yeah.
And it's also
a bit dated, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I was going to say it reads a bit drier. And yeah, it's probably another one of those, you know, dated books. But, you know, if you're wanting a Mauser rifle book, if you're not getting in some of like the specialty books, there's really like only three or so. Like, what was the book, Aaron, that you were talking about? Because you have that. I don't have that one. The Mechanical Variations.
Yeah, it's Mechanical Variations of the Mauser Bolt Action Military Rifles by James A. Wingate. And it uses Ball and Olson's books for reference as far as the most of the text, except for sometimes the author speaks to the person reading. But the big point of this one is that it has a lot of pictures and a lot of... Its main focus is the different mechanical variations between the different models. So it's referencing all Mauser models, but they don't go into super detail about anything except the mechanical aspect of it as far as that goes.
Yeah. I've seen that one for sale, and I just never quite felt like I needed to buy it. There's a bunch of other books I need to get first.
It's not a like one you would use like Ball to, like, this is this model. It's more of a secondary reference kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny. I brought the Johnson book to the hospital with it, just in case like I had time to kill and I could read it and take some notes or whatever.
That's a pretty decent book for collector and telling you what finishes and things like that, and also gives you historical.
The Johnson book is really good. Who did that one? Bruce Canfield. Bruce Canfield, yep. With Robert Lamore and Edward Johnson. Yeah, that is a good book. I read it. I read like half of it, and I wrote some notes on it for a video. I lost the notes, and I never did the video on the Johnson. I was gonna do it, but I saw Armorer's Bench. Shout out to Armorer's Bench YouTube channel. Underrated YouTube channel. Him and Ian both did Johnson rifle videos recently, and it kind of took the wind out of my sails because I'm like, now it's going to seem like I'm a copycat or something like that. And they covered a lot of the information that I was going to write and do in my video anyway.
I mean, you are, but anyway.
Yeah. But I'm going to switch. I'm actually going to do one on Argentine Mauser rifles next. I have the book by Webster on the Argentine Mauser rifles, so just gonna keep reading that because I think I read like a third of it. I need to go through and read more and continue my notes on it because that's another thing, you know, like South American guns. A lot of people just don't care about them, but they're I think they're really, you know, really neat guns with a lot of pretty interesting history. And some of the countries, you know, it's like Argentina that were early adopters, and you know, they had their Mausers for a long time. They go through all the different, lots of variations, mechanical variations between the earlier and the late.
I mean, some of those countries down there did fight, like in the Chaco War. You got Bolivia and Paraguay too, but
yeah. But it's like to most American collectors, like I guess if it wasn't a war that America fought in, we don't care about the guns from that war.
That's true if it's not in a video game or a movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So South American guns are pretty, I recommend them for like newer collectors.
We have quite a few times.
Yeah, because they're very plentiful. And they're high quality and very undervalued. You know, if they were appreciated as much as they deserved by the U.S. collectors market, they'd be a lot more expensive. But I guess I'm kind of glad they're not, you know, because you can still find them pretty good deals.
I mean, some of those are really rare and bring stupid money. I'll say that. But for the most part, you're right. I mean, they have shot up like an Argentine 1909 goes for over a grand now, I think. A nice one.
Yeah.
Or Chilean M95. Go ahead. Chilean 1895.
Yeah, I was really surprised about the Argentine 1891. My local honey hole, I don't know where they get these guns from, but they got like a big batch of Argentine Mausers in. And I was looking at their 1891, because the one I had was kind of junky, so I ended up selling it. But I needed another one for the Argentine video. And they had one. And I mean, this thing was really nice shape, like surprisingly nice. You know, no crest, you know, sadly, but it was really good shape. And I think I paid $500 for it, something like that. And I was talking to Don, and he's like, "Oh yeah, that's a big dollar gun nowadays, like a gun broker." It's like, really? Like they shot up that much? Like surprisingly.
And they're probably a $700 gun on Gun Broker now, no crest. I don't, maybe probably double that with a crest, but.
Man, I bought the last one I think I had for like $300.
And I paid $400 for mine.
And it was all matching, like Danny said, like it's all matching down to the clearing rod and like beautiful shape, no crest. And sometimes when they got rid of those crests, they were a little rough with that method.
Yeah.
Sometimes not so much. Sometimes it's like, whoa, guys, back off.
That's like how it is with Arasakas. Who's happy on the grinder that day?
Yeah. Yeah, it's real. And with Argentines too, it's interesting. They ground their crest off of the bayonets as well that they surplused, which is kind of weird.
Silly.
But only the 1891s, because there's the crests on the later ones that they surplused. But I went back. I don't know if you're talking, Mark, but I went back to the honey hole, and after I got the 1891, I went back and they had. I went back with Jared, and they had 5 1909s. So we just had them all laid out, and Jared and I just went through them one at a time, and we each picked out our favorite and got them. And that's the first time I think I've ever done that, like had like a bunch of nice examples and got to pick through them like a bunch like that. Because typically when I find stuff, like it's like one-offs, you know. But yeah, but I guess the short of that is I have some decent example Argentines now that I can show in the video when I make one, a video on it, which I'm only can really do because I have the Argentine Mauser book. Like, I can't really do a great video on, like, Brazilian Mauser evolution because there's not a Brazilian Mauser book. You know, you can go based on, like, ball and kind of cover the information like that, but, and there's no, like, unfortunately, there's not a lot of good information on Venezuelan Mausers. Van der Linden, he covers them very briefly in his FN Mauser book. But just not a lot of info out there.
I mean, Van der Linden's book on Belgian Mausers is super. Just to throw that out there, that's a really good book.
Oh, yeah.
Like, nobody knew anything about Belgian 18. I mean, I shouldn't say nobody knew anything, but Ball's book kind of skimmed the surface, but he really went nitty-gritty.
Yeah, yeah. Van der Linden's, his Mauser rifle and his pistol books are both really good. Which I think FN's kind of like an underappreciated like rifle, really, especially as far as, you know, Mausers go. It's kind of an unappreciated maker, because, I mean, I've talked to people who are like, you know, quote unquote gun people, and they're like, whoa, FN made Mausers? FN made guns back then? You know, like they just think of FN as like the modern arms, you know, maker, like the FN SCAR and stuff like that. So I'd always get a kick out of that.
I mean, Belgium, to my knowledge, was the first country to adopt the smokeless Mauser, and they were made by FN. So
were they made by FN in the beginning, or were they like a government?
In the beginning, and they were. I mean, they're a government arsenal, but FN made them for the Belgian government, and then MAE made some, but it was mostly FN. And then obviously later Hopkins and Allen, but
yeah. Yeah, I read some interesting like legal battles between Mauser and FN, with like competing for their later designs, because FN wanted to produce the later Mausers, and Mauser was like, yeah, well, the license that you bought from us, you could only produce like the 1889 pattern. Like, you can't produce our newer 1893 or 1898s, which I think that's why there's sort of a gap between FN making a whole lot of like 98 style up until past World War One.
Well, I think probably the war had something to do with it too, because you've got them and Brno making the short rifles in the 20s and 30s and exporting them.
Yeah, but I think it had something to do with Mauser losing their like copyrights or something like that after World War One. Like, it was one of the things they lost so other people could make them.
And then somehow they regained it back. I mean, I don't think they could make guns for the German army in the Weimar period. But they were able to export the standard model to China, Japan, wherever, Africa, all over the world.
Yeah,
that's another one I need, a good standard model, or a 1933,
or a Boer. How about a Boer?
Yeah, those would be nice too, but I don't know. There's some guns like I get they're super cool and nice, but like to me, they're not. It doesn't do enough for me to justify the cost. You know, like I would love if I ran across a Boer, like a, you know, Boer Mauser, you know, just out somewhere, and somebody just thought it was a generic old Mauser and it was cheap, like I'd you know, buy the crap out of it. But I don't know if I could pay like the thousands, or, you know, thousands and thousands that a genuine Boer rifles go for.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I find Boer Mausers cool, but not for the money they bring.
Yeah, that's interesting. The whole conflict is really interesting too, like good old jolly old England invading some poor little countries for their gold or diamonds, or both.
It was land. I'm not entirely sure of the whole causes.
Yeah, I think it was they started producing a ton of gold. Like, they opened up some gold mines that were like the number one producing gold mines in the world for like a few years, and then the British were like, ooh, we like that. So then they moved in, and it was a whole like escalation and justification that they use for it. But in the end, it was Great Britain wanting to colonize more places where the sun doesn't set, which nobody talks about that. There's a little digression. Nobody talks about England invading all these places for stuff. Because, like, England invading India, that was a pretty recent deal, you know, and then invading South Africa and taking it over. Like, that was pretty recent history. But, like, it's fine when England does it, but if another country did something like that, I feel like everybody would be up in arms, you know? Like, if the Germans conquered something like that, like, holy crap, it's a big deal, you know?
Yeah.
Have you guys noticed that? It just, when I look at history, it just seems that way. Like, the Brits get kind of a pass with the countries that they invade. Maybe a little bit the way we do now.
I wouldn't think necessarily in the countries that they feel that way.
Oh, no, not of course there, but, you know.
Maybe, like, are you saying, like, the rest of the world is kind of like that? I mean, Europe's not, you're not going to have anybody in Europe going to be doing that, because there's not going to be anybody finger-pointing and going, oh, look at you, and then they're going to be like, well, look at you.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's not like,
that'd be a little
hypocritical. It's not like France did really great in Eastern Asia.
Yeah, and I forgot the conference. What was that? There was the Berlin Conference of 18, I forgot the year, or the... The European nations, they split up Africa between them, and they divvied up the whole continent of land to everybody. I think the whole continent got split up except for Ethiopia.
Basically,
I think they stayed independent.
Yeah, and don't forget You know, like, even the smallest of countries were terrible. Belgium.
Yeah, that's something nobody talks about. Belgian Congo. Cheesy Pete's, man.
Yeah, if you guys ever want to look up how terrible and terrifying that Belgium was, look up the Belgian Congo.
Yeah, which is, you know, right before, like, World War One, which is so interesting because people are very, you know, poor Belgium during World War One. But it's like, hey, why don't you look at their Africa policies? See what they're doing over there before you feel too bad for them.
Yeah.
That was like an open secret, though. That was like the countries knew they were doing it, but they were still producing resources. So it was like, yeah, we're not going to bother you.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess there's money to be made.
It was rubber, I believe. Rubber was the big thing.
I think so.
Well, we got off topic a little bit.
I think it's expected, and I don't think from the feedback we get from people, I don't think they.
I'm not supposed to be.
Yeah, you better not, Aaron. You better not suggest we get back on topic ever, or they're gonna.
Well, I had to step away for a minute and talk to my daughter. Did we talk about Mannlicher books?
Oh God! Excuse me.
No, go ahead, Aaron.
Screw you, Mark.
I had to say it. Well, are we going to talk about Lee Navy books next? Excuse me.
Actually, there isn't one.
I thought there was one. Canfield has a book that covers them in a chapter.
Oh, yeah. It's like 15 pages. It's not a book. It's a pamphlet.
Well, no, it's a book that covers every U.S. military rifle, and it has a chapter on Lee Navy. Every military bolt rifle, I mean.
Anyway.
And go ahead.
So, in English, there are basically two choices for you guys out there, all 12 of us that collect M95s. And that's the Scarletta book, which is Mannlicher Military Rifles, Straight Pull and Turn Bolt Designs. And the other one, which is Mannlicher Rifles and Pistols, Famous Sporting and Military Weapons, which is by Walter H.B. Smith. I have the Walter H.B. Smith one, and essentially what this one is, there's actually a book that was written by a gentleman named Von Kromar, and he's an Austrian gentleman, and his book is actually really interesting. It's a detailed, large print scanning of the original patent drawings for all of Mannlicher's patents, which is awesome. It's only available in Europe. I've never been able to find a copy of it. There are no translation. There's no talking about guns in it. It's just large print pictures of the patent drawings. And what Walter did is he translated some of the pictures and diagrams, put them in a smaller format print, which kind of lost some of the detail, obviously, but it's still there. And he wrote a book where he describes, with his opinions and ideas, some of the details behind the models and everything like that. So I'd recommend this one, just so you can see the patent drawings. It's super interesting. There's a lot of stuff that I didn't know that Mannlicher was working on. He was really... I mean, when we talk about straight pull action being a thing. Mark, we can hear your thing. Can you hear me?
I think he's having technical difficulties.
Mark? Okay.
What was going on?
We sounded like you were in a wind tunnel.
Continue.
Anyway, it's got a lot of different patents and drawings in here of stuff that were never made it past prototype stage. So it's kind of neat to see some of the stuff that he was working on and coming up with ideas for. But as far as like detailed information, you're not going to find it. This is mostly just a brief overview of the different models and the different patent drawings. Scarletta's book I do not own. I talked to Othias about it. It's a decent one, but it's not got all of the right information. I don't know what's wrong, but I've been told by multiple people, actually, that it's not got everything correct, which I don't know how you could say everything's correct, but It's not that expensive. These are not. This one's not out of print. I'm looking at it right now on Amazon. It's $40. So if you want to, that's a good example to get some nice full color pictures, because Walter Smith's book is black and white. So, but if, unless you speak or read German, there's really not a lot of reference books for the M95 in English.
Yeah, there's. I've noticed quite a few times I'm wanting to do a video on something like Norwegian crags, and the only book on Norwegian crags, or at least like a real comprehensive one, it's in Norwegian. So, and it's one of those things where like I don't know if Google Translate would do a like great job, you know, translating like technical words, like what different parts mean, that sort of thing. I mean, not even English books always do a great job and with technical translations, but yeah, there's a lot of books out there that are in their kind of only in their native language, and that'd be a cool thing. Like, I have no idea what would go into getting books translated like that, like especially books that are out of print. But that'd be a pretty neat thing if there was a modern publishing company that was, you know, actively trying to translate, you know, different books. Polish Mausers is another thing. There's a good book on Polish Mausers, but it's in Polish. I can't find like an English version. I don't think there is one. So it's, again, it's like a weird one of those. It's one of those things.
Well, I mean, I guess if you really want to get heavy into this stuff, you have to learn the language. It sucks, but it is what it is.
Yeah, which is pretty. It's pretty nuts. You got to learn the. Got to learn the language of the primary sources.
Well, I mean, stuff. Oh, I'm sorry, Mark. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Aaron.
I was going to say, some of this stuff is going to be super hard to find, especially for losing sides. Like, there is no Austro-Hungarian Empire. So, like, where did all the data go? Like, we don't know. It's probably just gone.
Oh, yeah.
Like
is there a good book on Ottoman stuff?
Yeah.
Other than, like, Gaul?
Even stuff like Japanese stuff. I don't think they hung on to all that data. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's a lot of stuff in the JSDF archives. I mean, there are guys over in Japan that still, I mean, the laws are stringent, but they still study that stuff. I think when it comes to Japanese rifles, there's a lot of good books in English. When it comes, yeah. And the pistol too, but the machine guns are a different story. There are a couple people here that really know the machine guns, and but there's no really good books in English. A friend of mine actually helped write a book. He's American, but his friend is Japanese, and a lot of his guns are in there, but it's all in Japanese. There's nothing really in English in the machine guns, but I digress.
Yeah, you got to think about like a losing side. They're not going to keep all of the detailed data necessarily. That's why some of the stuff's so hard to find information on.
Yeah.
Or the idea that some of this stuff we're looking at is over, what, 100 years old, 120 years old? The data's lost.
Or bombed.
Didn't Morrow say, Danny, that they were just the Mauser company when they reformed, they just threw shit out?
Which Mauser company? The modern one?
Yeah, the modern one. Didn't they just like throw a bunch of stuff away?
I know. I think he was talking about the when the French took over, and then when the French had to demolish it because of Soviet pressure. When they demolished the Oberndorf factory.
Right. Yeah. So they didn't keep all the records. They were just like, who would want these?
Yeah. Now, luckily for that, I think Mauro said that it was a lot of the locals just took in the documents. Just a lot of people. I think the locals there were like really big fans of the Mauser factory and the history and everything like that. Like, I think they were really big supporters of it. So I think a lot of them took a lot of the original source documents like home, you know, in their places and stuff like that, which is one of the things Mauer and the Paul Mauser archive has been, you know, doing, is getting all those original documents and compiling them in one place. But I think that was more about just the, you know, losing the war and then, yeah, occupation and the destruction of the factory because of the Soviets, which itself is a pretty interesting thing too. Mario's done, he's in a couple books, or I guess he's sort of co-authored a couple books. but his Paul Mauser book is really good because that kind of covers like the start of the Mauser company and up until, you know, World War II, you know, towards the end. And then his book, The Parabellum Is Back, kind of picks off kind of after the war, which is pretty interesting.
We can't plug Morrow enough. Like, the stuff he's been able to discover about Mauser and his life has been very interesting.
And he's very, like, free and open with his knowledge. He has, like, free articles and stuff that he
and
posts.
And pictures,
like,
of everything, too.
Yeah. I mean, you can follow him, like, on Facebook and stuff, and he just puts out stuff for free because he's one of those guys, and he's, you know, done videos with me, you know, like, for free just to, you know, get the word out. And he's one of the good ones. Morrow's one of the good ones.
He's a very nice guy, too. I feel the need to say that.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, very, very nice guy. I think he speaks at least three languages. It's pretty crazy.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Italian, German, I want to say French.
I think French. Yeah, because he lives in Belgium, so I bet it's French. You ever heard the joke? What do you call a person that speaks three languages?
No.
Trilingual. What do you call a person that speaks two languages?
Bilingual.
What do you call a person who speaks one language?
American,
yeah. We didn't touch on North Cape Publications. I meant to bring that up earlier, Mark.
Oh, I'm actually looking at their website right now.
Yeah.
They're some decent books.
They have a book on Swedish Mauser rifles, which, since Crown Jewels exists, like, I don't know why this book exists. But they're one on Swiss. They have a Swiss magazine loading rifles, 1869 to 1958. I think that's about the only book that I can think of on Swiss guns, on Swiss bolt guns.
In English, probably.
There is a book series in German that covers all the Swiss stuff. I have a couple copies. It's four or five volumes, but it's out of print. It's long out of print.
Yeah, see, that's another one to get. If it's out of print, like, who would, I don't know, there's got to be some legal hoops or something to jump through, but if it's out of print, who would argue with somebody else printing it, maybe, for royalty or translate it? That'd be another good one to get translated and reprinted, you know? Yeah. We need to start a publishing company.
The issue is always, Danny, is who's the target audience and how much money you're going to make. Like, unless you've got a lot of money to sink and give back to the publisher, they're not going to spend the money on this.
That's true. That is true. And I think unless you're, like, famous, it's really hard to sell a niche book. Yeah. Because if you're famous, apparently you can sell any book about any topic and sell millions of dollars worth of... Because, man, Ian's been blowing it out of the water with his books.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. I don't own his books. You know, he did the French one. He did the British Bullpups one.
Did he do that one? I thought he was
a collab. I think it was a collab. I guess what I mean, like, he did it, like, his publishing. I'm not even sure. Like, does he own that publishing company?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't really know. But those are pretty niche topics, maybe not the French firearm ones, but
it wasn't niche until he came along.
Yeah, nobody did it. Nobody cared about French guns at all until Ian. Not one collector in the whole United States cared about French. I can see Mark's face getting red as I say.
There were a few, but I mean, it certainly brought him to the limelight.
I mean, those guys are weirdos anyway.
Everybody's got their opinion. I mean, some people like straight pull man liquors and think Lee Navies are rare, but...
I never said they were rare. I'm sorry, how many do you have, Mark?
How many greener made Belgian 89s do you have? How many Ross 1910s do you have? diverted Argentine 91 Spanish American war guns do we have? You want to go on and on?
But we're not discussing that.
And how about this? How many K98Ks do you have? Because that's the only gun that's rare.
I have none.
my all matching unfired K98K.
That still seems, there? Yeah, this seems to be the thing that... Yeah, Mark, are you there? Can you hear us?
What?
Can you hear us?
Yeah, the internet on the moon's pretty bad.
Hello?
Yeah.
Mark is in the moon, apparently.
He's in Maine. Officially, the mail gets to us quicker from France than it does from Maine.
Yeah, I have proof of that.
Hello.
Yeah, I bought a picture. I bought a picture from Europe, and also was waiting on mail from Maine, and the picture from Europe got to my place first. So I can second that, Aaron.
He's still trying to figure out what's going on. Anyway. Well, Danny, what else would we like to talk about as far as books go? Did we discuss... I'm sorry, because I had to step away. Did we discuss avoiding those... Oh, son of a gun.
Yeah, we did. We talked a little bit about avoiding the coffee table books, like the...
But also the books that talk about prices.
Oh, yeah, we didn't go into that. Yeah, the blue books, gun value books.
Yeah,
which are,
don't do that.
They fluctuate too much to keep track.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, I think I talked about in the past podcast about how Norwegian Crags seem to be hovering around the $1,000 mark. And then right after Othias's video, they jumped up and they were selling for like $3,000 a piece. And I went back and looked, and now they've seemed to like half that. They seem to be about $1,500 mark now. So it seems, yeah, they do fluctuate quite a bit. And it's interesting, like, that YouTube and pop culture, whatever, can influence, like, guns. But yeah, they really do. I guess if you take it, there's no perfect metric for value, right? Because there's, like, some people don't even, if you can have, plenty of examples of a gun selling for a certain amount on GunBroker, but some people just say, like, that doesn't count, right? Because it's people are bidding and they get competitive and whatever. Or they think that the blue book is the only real value of it, and they take that for gospel. But I think a lot of us have experiences at gun shows of dealers or whatnot whipping out the blue book and educating us people on the true value of our whatever we brought in or are trying to buy. You guys ever had that happen to you at a show?
No, actually.
Yeah. Some dealers, they'll have like a blue book, and a lot of times it'll be like an older copy. They never get into that, and they never say the age of the book or whatever. But if you bring a pistol up to them or whatever, and they're looking at it, they're going to whip out this blue book. They'll say, okay, here's the blue book. It says it's worth 500. So I need to sell it for $5, so I'll buy it from you. They'll do something like that. In actuality, that gun's like a $1,000 gun now, you know. I've seen quite a lot of people do that at shows over the years, like dealers and stuff. They got their blue books under the table. Some of that's probably because they don't know the internet exists still.
Or it might be intentional.
Yeah, they could be taking advantage.
What would be fun to be would be to come in there and play the young guy who's ignorant with a rare gun over your back, and then you'll know who's honest and who's not. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love that. I've thought a lot about doing that at shows, actually, like bringing something in there and just being like, oh, like, it can't be too rare because then nobody will know about it. Like you're saying.
Johnson would be perfect.
Johnson or a G43.
Yeah. Just like go to a show with my G41 over my shoulder and be like, yeah, this is my grandpappy's. What? I don't know. I want a SKS. Huh?
He was in some beach in France and brought this back.
Yeah, yep. Which I've legitimately. I was working at a show in Tallahassee, and a kid walked in with a 1903 sniper, whatever those are called.
The A4.
Yeah, and he walked up to a vendor and handed it to the vendor, and he was like, "Here, this was my grandpa's. I just want an AR-15. Like, would you trade?" And the vendor's like, pick whatever AR-15 you want.
You want a Knights arm? No.
Yeah, no. Of course he didn't get anything like a Knights. No, he probably just got a kind of who knows generic, a DPMS or something.
Christ.
Quality, yeah. What are you talking about?
Yeah, geez. Which is, I don't know if I've ever told this story, but I was helping I forgot how old I was. 17, 18, it's pretty young. And there was a widow that was moving out of her house, and I think it was her her husband, yeah, her husband was, yeah, was a vet, World War II vet. And I was helping her clean out her house and getting everything packed up. And we went up to the attic. And I found in the attic in this back corner that she had a bunch of like, you know, there's a bunch of guns back there. And there was a paratrooper M1 carbine, you know, the folding stock, and there's a 1903 and some other ones that like I didn't know what they were at the time. I wasn't that into milsurps, but I remember I found those and I knew what the paratrooper M1 was, and I was just like, holy crap, you know. And I think I said something like, oh, you know, I'll buy these from you or whatever. And she's like, oh no, I'm going to give them to somebody. But, yeah, that was one of those things that's not super common anymore. You know, those attic finds, those vet bring back attic finds and stuff. But that's an interesting thing. Another digression is like I wonder how a lot of American surplus got back, you know, cause it's pretty straightforward on like captured stuff, you know, American soldier finds it and ships it back or brings it back with them or whatever. But like, and if they bring in back an American gun, then they're kind of breaking the law.
Well, I've heard stories, yeah, after World War I, you could buy your pistol, service pistol, for X amount of dollars. But I think that stuff happened probably more in World War I, but II, a different story. Obviously, some of it got smuggled back, but...
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'd really like to know about this, the pistol that I have that was... The story that was told to me was like my grandpa brought it back from the war, but it's a, you know, it's a Remington Rand 1911, and I have no clue. I've seen too much stuff that's like people making it up. Like here's a Spanish 1916 and 7.62. My grandpappy brought it back from the war. Like, you know, there's too many stories like that. Like I sort of doubt the validity of my own, you know, of this gun sort of too. I can never get rid of it, obviously, in case it is, you know, legit. But
it's certainly possible with something like that, but you can't say 100%, obviously. So,
yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, my grandpa that brought it back, he died before I was even born, so never talked to him, and my dad didn't know much.
Yeah.
Here's something. This is just something off topic completely, but something I've been thinking of recently. Like, do you guys think it's cooler to have like 20 sort of a certain type of gun that's maybe, you know, more common or whatever, or one gun that's pretty uncommon or maybe rare?
The one rare gun.
Cooler?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd rather have the one rare. Like, anytime like I posted a Lee Navy, people are always like, what the hell is that? If you post that Johnson, Danny, people are like, what the frick is that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That factor is pretty high.
Yeah, there's a 41M that I found for sale, and I've been thinking a lot about it.
A 41M?
Yep, yep. G41M.
Is that the one they made for the Germans? No, that's the G9840.
No, that's the bolt-action semi-auto Mauser submission.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I was thinking of Hungary.
The 43M to the 9840 is what you're thinking of.
Yeah, there is a 41 that I think it's a prototype.
The 33M was a prototype. I think there was another. There's the M41 Dreyse, but I couldn't. There might have been some kind of Hungarian prototype. But go on, Danny.
Well, I found this the G41M, and I've wanted one for a while, but it is quite pricey. And so I've been sort of thinking about like what all, you know, I'd have to sell in order to buy it. And then I get into like this sort of predicament of like, what would I enjoy more? Like, you know, you have, in one hand, you have like one gun, or you have like 20 guns, you know, like you have 20 different variations, 20 different, you know, possibly 20 different calibers and sizes and everything, you know, maybe 20 different experiences, you know, taken out and shooting, or you have, you know, just the one.
Right.
That's a toughie.
It's hard to say. I mean, it's take it by with a case by case basis.
Yeah. Or like, I've always had a fantasy of owning a transferable MG34.
You want a 42, you don't want a 34, but trust me.
Oh, really?
I've seen them both in action. The 34s, from what this is just my limited experience. They don't run as well. They're a lot more finically. The 42 runs like a top.
Huh.
But they're a lot more money because everybody knows what a 42 is.
42s are more than 34s? That's interesting.
I think this is on average a 34 is around a 25 to 35K gun. And 42 is like 50 to 70K, maybe 50 to 60K.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit less. I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to look at realized prices, but these are for transferable, not dealer samples.
Yeah, yeah. Have you played with Gage's 34?
Gage doesn't have a 34. That's not his.
Oh, okay.
I fired a friend of his, and that was the one that was finicky. I fired a 42, and let's just say that thing ran.
Yeah, man. But, yeah. So that's just sort of the predicament I've just been thinking about, like, because my collection is getting to like a size where it's, and I know you're well past this point, Mark, but like mine's getting a bit like unwieldy, especially with I'm probably gonna move in like a year. I like think about the logistics and the pain and everything. So I just thought about like paring down the collection, where instead of having like, you know, a larger number of less common guns, just a few, you know, uncommon ones. It got really quiet, you guys.
Yeah, sorry. I'm also very tired. I spend all day cleaning our house because I'm home alone, and my one daughter is in Florida, my other daughter is in Central Illinois, and my wife is in California at a conference. So I've spent all day cleaning our house, and it's 92 today. It's just been fun, hot.
Yeah, yeah. It is a heat wave right now. A friend of mine from Arizona just sent me 117 degrees.
Well, so it's a dry heat.
I don't know, man. I've been to Arizona, southern Arizona, Phoenix, in the summer.
Isn't that like King of the Hill, where they go to Phoenix and he's like, "Dear Lord, it's like being on the surface of the sun."
I flew into Phoenix and I stepped out of that airport. And I, you know, went outside, and my first thought was like, this can't be real. Like, what's going on? How is it this hot? And it was like a heat that I've never experienced, like, unless you're like in front of an oven or just
like, yeah, your body's just like, whoa, this is something is very wrong.
Yeah. I mean, a person that grew up, lived in Florida their whole lives up until that point, you know, that I thought I knew heat, and then I went to Arizona, and then it's just a completely different monster, which, like, I couldn't do it, man. I don't think I can do heat like that. That's one good thing about the Midwest. You know, it doesn't get quite that hot. I think I'd take a little bit of colder winter over the crazy heat. What is it in Maine right now, Mark? Is it a sweltering 65?
If Mark's with us still with his dial-up internet. He appears to not be.
Oh, it's 67 in Portland, Maine right now.
It's 88 right now here. And it's almost 8 o'clock. So it's like the sun's barely even out right now, and it's still hot.
Stifling.
Mark says it's 66.
Yeah.
Oh, but
I've experienced the like opposite of like the exact opposite of the Arizona heat phenomenon in Maine. When I was working in Maine in the winter, and I knew it was cold, and I legitimately put on, because I was there for work, so I didn't have like an entire wardrobe, but I put on every piece of warm clothing that I had, and I went out and I was walking around like downtown Portland, Maine, and it was also so effing cold, I couldn't believe it. So it's two the opposite poles there. Well, I think we have thoroughly explored this reference book topic, if we were digressing this much at this point.
Well, at least it's a
dry probably
cold up here.
What, Mark?
It's a dry cold up here. Yeah. 6 here, but I don't know what happened. I've had all these technical difficulties.
Yeah.
I also want to... Scott Holmes wanted me to mention him on the chat, by the way. He's the brother of Mike Holmes, who's in our group. He just wanted me to throw his name out there and say hello before we close, okay?
Okay. It's all good. Any more shout outs? That's That's good. Oh, I was going to invite Hamish on again. Hamish, the New Zealander, because I love his accent. Yours isn't bad either, Mark.
Believe it or not,
what?
I was going to say, I don't think I have that thick of a Maine accent, but you can tell me I'm wrong. I mean,
you're wicked wrong.
I mean, it's not a really thick accent.
They park your car in the yard.
No, he's not going to do it right now. It's not going to make any difference right now. But he's not like Mark Wahlberg, like that level of Boston accent.
That's different.
Yeah, it's different. But some of the stuff is similar, but it's different.
True. But anyway, continue, boys.
I think we're actually about done.
So in conclusion of this reference book podcast, it's smart. You need the book, especially depending on the investment of the gun that you want. You want to buy the book. You want to do the reading first. But a lot of times you'll run across something and it's either you buy it or you don't right away. So you kind of lean on the internet or whatever to quickly, you know, sort of figure out. Because I don't think most people are going to buy every single gun book out there, read them all before they start collecting any gun. So a lot of it is you kind of, you know, learn as you go.
Yeah. But I mean, there's some of these though, that you could buy that you could get. Like there's tons of information on Lee Enfields. There's tons of information out there on Mausers and stuff like that that you can look up and have beforehand. Or a big takeaway, Danny, that I think we should make a big point of is that before you invest in something that's really expensive, if you're like, oh, this is really expensive, do your research.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess how expensive is worth it just depends on, I guess, how much money you have.
Because... Yeah, but like, that's what I'm saying is like if to whoever it is, if you say to yourself, this is an expensive purchase, you need to have researched that thoroughly.
Yeah, because I think there's a lot of people with more money than like with so much money that they don't care. And I guess they're able to just throw it around. Like it's easier to just buy something than it is to
take the chance.
Research. No, I mean, like, they'd be willing to take the chance and
buy
something.
That's what I'm saying. They'd really be willing to take the chance.
Yeah. There's one gun in particular that I see people get burned on all the time. How did I do after spending $2,000? It's a K98 Mauser. Buy the books. Get on the internet and research on the 98K form. Don't be stupid. You know, don't go out and blow $2,000 on a fake gun because you think it's matching. They renumber and scrub those things all the time.
Uh-huh. Yep. I just recently at a show here, I saw a supposed all matching gun, and you could really go and look at it, and you could see the numbers were just really off on this gun. It was an obviously like renumbered K98K.
Smell that cold.
Yeah, you know what? That's something too. Smelling guns. I don't think people appreciate that enough.
Okay.
Like how cold much you know? Like, you.
I'm gonna have to say what?
I'm 100%.
You're cutting out, Mark.
Once you know what cold blue smells like, that's a good thing. It also can kind of fade to brown. You've got to know what it looks like. That's one way a lot of people will improve.
Yeah. Like there was, I forgot what gun, this was years past. I think it was the Lee Enfield or something like 10 years ago I was looking at. And it was in good shape. So I picked it up. And I don't know why, but I smelled it. And I smelled like fresh paint on the gun. And I was like, oh. Okay, like this is crap. Like somebody actually just like painted it. Because there's some guns like that the legit finish is paint, you know. And a lot of times those are pretty, you know, pretty easy to, you know, to fake of being in better condition or to.
Yeah, the French thing. Post-war.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the French. Yeah, French stuff. Trying to think of another one. Drawing a blank. But yeah, cold blue, like Mark said, that's a good one if you can smell it. Sometimes wood, huh?
The Belgians painted a lot of stuff in World War II onward black.
Oh
even
yeah,
before World War II. But anyway, the stain on wood, I guess you can smell that too.
Yeah, you can smell. Yeah, the stain on wood, you can smell if it was, you know, BLO'd like Bode linseed oiled recently or, you know, shellacked or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like you could definitely smell that. Something like red 9 grips, like on a C96, if you want to know it's legit, you can kind of smell the wood, you know, and you can, a fresh piece of wood will smell, you know, or even a piece of wood that's, you know, like you know, less than 5 years old will smell different than a, than, you know, 100-year-old piece of wood. So, that's something too. Just, use your nose, and you just never think of it when inspecting a gun, but especially something of, you know, high value. Smell the wood.
Yeah.
And I legitimately don't know how we got onto that topic, but
I think we were talking about investing and mm-hmm. doing your research beforehand. That's how we got onto there, is that, uh-huh. you know, the books are great resources for your everyday purchases or whatever, but it's a really key resource if you're going to be getting into the more rare investments.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're gonna
so
be...
you don't get burned. And it may not even be a malicious person trying to burn you. It's they were told this, and now they're passing yep. it along.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
100%.
So that, there's just a lot of misinformation, and the internet's helped and hurt in that regard. The misinformation spreads fast, but so does the correct information, too. So you just gotta look up multiple places. Don't just look at Wikipedia.
And don't trust everything you read on Facebook.
Well, Mark, you are a hoarder, and I shouldn't really talk to you.
I want to just finish on that point. I just want to reiterate that people who buy more than one of, collect a certain type of gun aren't hoarders. They like them, and there's a lot of stuff out there. You just need to look for it. Don't complain.
I what do you mean? I'm not saying anything with my 10 M95s.
Hoarder.
You're ruining the M95 market, Aaron.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm ruining it for all 12 of us.
There are dozens of people out there upset at you.
What's his name? Victor? Victor, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Victor, yes, with a W.
Yes. And then maybe two other people.
We don't really compete, Victor and I, though. He kind of has kind of fallen off as far as collecting because he got married recently.
Well, good for him, but I hope he gets back into it, though. He's a nice guy.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to buy his... he has an M95, the really, really badly faked Nazi one.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. That's the one I was going to buy from him. He's got like, it's got 6 SS stamps on it and like 7 or 8 Waffenamts. It's really terrible. And I was just like, I want that for the audacity.
Like buying a High Point Yeet cannon?
Yeah, just be like, look at this example of what somebody thought was like a legit thing to try.
I forgot to tell you, Aaron, I saw, At the Olathe gun shop here, I saw an SS marked M95.
No, really?
Yep.
Why?
Yep. I've not seen one in person.
I was expecting it to be covered in them, like, you know, have a bunch of swastika eagles, all dirty birds covering the whole thing. But it was just like one death's head stamp on it. So I was like, oh, that's actually not as obtuse as a lot of the other.
Wow, a death's head. Even the one that Victor has does not have that.
Oh, yeah. See, you got to own all the variations of the fakes now.
Did it have Waffenamts or no?
No.
Oh, so it was literally just a death's head? That's so stupid.
Yeah, I can't even remember where it was stamped at, but yeah, it was just one Totenkopf on it, which was, like, cool.
What a waste.
Yeah, that's true. There's, some of that stuff is pretty nuts. Okay, so at my local gun show, there's some guys that I know, and one of them, he's like, "Hey man, check this thing out that I got." He got it at the show of shows in Kentucky. He got it off of this old collector who's had it forever, and he busts out this case, and there's stamps of every type of cartouche or whatever marking that you could think of that was ever on any variation of U.S. Like 1903 or Krag or M1. And it was like, it was the like, it was hundreds of stamps of all different shapes and sizes and everything. And
like legit ones or fakes?
I think it was fakes. Like, I think somebody years ago, probably decades and decades ago, put this thing together. And he was like, "Check this out. I got this from a big collector who was like retiring. I got it for like next to nothing." And he's like, "I got it just because it's cool, but like, look how crazy this is." And again, that's one of those things, like, you know, there's all the stamps and stuff are out there. Like, you can You can stamp a gun, you know, or anything with it. Which
I can make my M1 only... all matching.
Oh, yep. Which I did recently go into a gun shop, a local gun shop, and they had on the wall in big letters, International Harvester, all matching. Which I was like, that's good stuff. All numbers matching. I was like, that's, yep. I love that.
Quality. That's how you know it's love quality. That stuff.
Yep.
For those that don't understand the joke, there's only one serial number on all U.S. firearms.
Yeah, U.S. guns aren't all serialized, all the parts and stuff, like, together with the main gun. So you can have a correct gun, but you can't have an all-matching serial number gun.
Anyway, I think we're just rambling at this point. I'm going to go get some dinner.
All right. This was a good one. This was a good bring back podcast for a while. Bringing it back.
Oh, man, it stopped recording. I'm kidding.
No way.
I'm kidding.
Oh, my God.
I'm kidding.
We joke because that's happened twice to us.
I'm kidding. It recorded the whole thing. All right, I'll... unless you guys have anything else, Mark, you're in a windstorm again.
There were some American handguns that had serialized parts, and some of the early Craigs that serialized parts.
Oh, here we go. Here we go.
But anyway, that's a different story for a different
Actually.
Day.
Actually.
Yes. All right. Have a good night, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mark, for coming. And you guys have a good night.